that's this episode 40 of the season. My name is Dave Parkinson. I finally brushed the cold aside from joining alongside Adrian Jackson, and we're here for another week of rugby league action.
One thing I can say, I look forward to cold, and yes, it is episode 40, but the finishing line is within touching distance.
It is. We've got literally two more weeks of rugby league podcast action of the season, but it's been a great year. Getting it even better. We're in the international stages of the season now. We've got the Gillette formations happening as we speak. Preparations ongoing for the next round of fixtures, which will see England travel to Hull to take on New Zealand and Australia travel to Wrexham to take on Wales. There's also the small matter of the European Rugby League Championships, which was won by France, but only after a battle over in Ireland.
Good to see a British contest win some of this autumn.
Bobby Gould, of course, yes. And considering that he nearly sacked himself a few weeks ago, he's done pretty well, hasn't he?
I'm sure he would have had a glass of red wine or a glass of ale bubbly after that hard-fought victory against Ireland. Fair play to Ireland. They made a game of it, didn't they? And, despite the Wolfhounds improving as the games went by during this European International Series, it's ended with the third straight defeat for Mark Aston. Plenty of positives he can take from that tournament and improved the Ireland team. I think it's used to being an international rugby league coach.
Plenty of young players as well in the Ireland lineup, the likes of Tim Bergin, of course. We know plenty about him for his time at Sheffield Eagles, but lads like Elliot Cosgrove and Joe Taylor starting to make the mark for Ireland. And it's a bit of a change of the guard, isn't it? We've spoken about it over the course of the last few weeks as far as Scotland are concerned, the fact that they've bloodied some youngsters. But another real positive was the fact that this was played in Limerick. Now, if I know rugby league, I probably know that there wasn't perhaps that much advertising done on this particular game. And 3,100 people turned up. That's a great attendance, that.
Just showed you that maybe an interesting rugby league in Ireland, doesn't it? And that's the first ever game in Foreman Park in Limerick. So to get over 3,000 for such an occasion, well, the signs are positive, aren't they?
They are, and that's probably the first time that they've taken a game away from Dublin as well, isn't it, when they've gone over to Ireland. So there really is a good groundswell that they can possibly build on for future years, though. As we mentioned, France, they were too strong in the end. Great game from Kane Bentley as well. The Lesignan hooker having a smashing game. He's had a smashing series, doesn't he?
Yeah, his reputation gets bigger, doesn't it, within the game of rugby league in France. And he was only one of three players that never played for the Catalan Dragons last year that was in that team.
Although he does have a previous record with the Catalan Dragons, doesn't he? But, yeah, Bentley scored a hat-trick. Olivia Lima scored two tries, Thomas Boss scored a try, and kicked five goals from six attempts.
Special mention is going to go to Irish winger Joe Taylor, not a name that's on everybody's lips within the World Rugby League in the UK. He plays for North Dublin, and he scored his first ever hat trick.
It was tremendous. Tim Bergin opened the Irish scores after 5 minutes. Taylor then scored his first try after 15 minutes, his second after 43, and his third after 74.
I'm saying his first ever hat trick, obviously his first hat trick. I'm saying it's his first ever hat trick. It is, and he's obviously done that in his amateur days, but to go and do that on an international stage, that's his first hat trick.
That's at least the first of many, perhaps, for a young Joel Taylor. He got 9 out of 10 from the guy who was writing the report in the League Weekly anyway, so he must have impressed him.
Yeah, like I said, his name new on me, and obviously Mark Aston's got a lot of faith in this young boy from Dublin. Maybe we might see him over here becoming, is it firstly the next Brian Carney, or is he going to be the one and only Joel Taylor?
He was going to say the one and only Jesse Marks there. No, Joel Taylor, though, he's got previous of Mark Aston for being able to spot that potential, hasn't he? And it wouldn't be a surprise, to be honest, to see him perhaps turning out for Sheffield next year.
Who knows? Now, with France finishing top, and lifting the European trophy to be crowned the champions of the autumn international series, what happens to France now?
Did they get promoted? Are they going to be in the Four Nations again, or have we even got a Four Nations competition next year? Does it go down under again?
No, they said the Four Nations next year, that's due to the Rugby League World Cup that's happening in the UK in 2013, but it'd be interesting to see what happens to France in the next Four Nations. Really have to have a playoff with the team that's in the Australasia tournament, or the Eagle Straight.
This is getting very, very confusing, isn't it? You know, especially when you bear in mind that Papua New Guinea have been playing around about a similar sort of time. Fiji have also been playing. Cook Islands have been playing over in down under as well. So who knows? I don't think the rugby league knows yet. Before we get onto the subject of the Gillette Four Nations, I just want to concentrate just for a couple of minutes on the annual Rugby League International Federations Award Nights. Now, this took place in the middle of last week, and although England got plenty of invites, there were no winners.
No, obviously, it'd been off to the tower for this selection of winners, wouldn't it have to be in the attitude for the English camp? But wasn't to be. It took place in the Tower of London, a nice grand venue to have such a prestigious event. And the player at the moment was Billy Sletty, the man that was crowned International Player of the Year.
Looking at some rather interesting pictures which show various England international pack members stood alongside defeaters, and I suppose you won't mind a couple of them beefing up the England pack, would you?
Certainly that's correct. I might have the absence of Jamie Peacock for the rest of the Four Nations. I think Steve McManara might be checking out whether some of them beefeaters to play rugby league for.
It's certainly interesting, but you mentioned that Billy Slater, he got the award for Player of the Year. The Spirit of the Rugby League Award went to David Oxley. Now, I think he's still involved within the sport, isn't he? Certainly at some level. Rookie of the Year was Gerald Yoye from Brisbane Broncos. Coach of the Year, Desi Asler from Manly Sea Eagles. Referee of the Year, Tony Archer from Australia. Thank goodness he wasn't heavy ref on the weekend between Australia and England.
You've been controversial, what, Henry Perrin Arthur?
Always controversial, mate. I thought you'd ignore that after 40 weeks sitting alongside me.
Also, on the night after naming those individual awards, the Rugby League International Federation named the Team of the Year, World Super League, and the NRL always named a 13-man team for the end of season Dream Team. It was slightly different in the RLIF, and they've decided to name a 9-man team, but no one from Super League got a sniff of being in it.
It was also an occasion for the Nations Players of the Year as well. So there were several other nations which were also high. There were several other nations involved who also saw players named as the Player of the Season. Canada saw Matt Wiles named. Cook Islands saw Tini Raiola named. The Czech Republic had Jan Rubin. Fiji, Wes Nkwama. France, Remy Casti. Germany, Thomas Isaac. Ireland, Tim Bergin. Italy, Matteo Rossi. Jamaica, Tyrone Rowe. Japan. I didn't realise that we had a Japanese international side, but Yasuki Kinoshita, he managed to win the award there. Malta saw Clifford De Batista with the award. Norway had Sonny Mauer. Lebanon, Valid Yassin. Russia, Eduardo Sokov. Samoa, George Carmont, Scotland's Dale Ferguson, Serbia's Dalibor Fukonovic, South Africa's Ian Kramer, Sweden's Alexander Rappenstad, Tonga's Felicio Mateo, Ukraine's Vladimir Mashkin, America's brilliantly named Apple Pop, and Wales' new witness signing lightweight.
I'm actually impressed with your pronunciations of those Russian players. I'm impressed. And your Japanese really stood out.
I tell you, they could put me on, come dancing or something.
It's having all sushi by your ordering.
So there were certainly some tongue twisters there anyway, that's for sure. But congratulations to everybody. Let's hope that England can actually get a player named. But I'm wondering why there wasn't an England player named in the Nations Players. Very interesting.
I think the reason you find that if you look at the Nations Player of the Year awards, they come from countries that are considered to be minor nations instead of the big guns of Australia, New Zealand and England. When you look at some of the countries, it just shows you how far rugby league has progressed over the years, and there is a lot of work going in to the rugby league in those nations.
It is progressing, isn't it? And it's quite surprising that I went through that list. I didn't know that we've got a Japanese team, so that's a new one on me. So looking, and we've read about what's been happening with Serbia and Russia, and very encouraging signs there, for sure. But they still have a long way to go until they're able to come up with a four-nation this weekend with one of the matches. But before we look at Australia and England in a little bit more detail, let us first of all take in what happened between Wales and New Zealand. This was quite a one-sided game, to be honest. New Zealand 36, Wales 0. Your thoughts, Adrian?
I was just going to say, you're trying to say the Wales-New Zealand game wasn't competitive.
It was competitive, but it wasn't close.
No, it wasn't. It really was. I was just saying that in jest. Wales totally dominated by a powerful early surge from the New Zealanders. And encouragingly for Steve McManaman's men, you can look at that game between Wales and New Zealand, and they can probably pick a few weaknesses from that New Zealand lineup in the sense that they never really played for the full 80.
They had a couple of opportunities where they could really have put the foot to the metal and really throttled the Welsh, but it never really happened, did it?
No, that's fair play to Wales, though. They obviously knew the damage was done in that first half. In fact, the damage was done in the opening 20 minutes, really, wasn't it? And he had to really roll the sleeves up and make more of a game of it in the second half than he did then.
Tell you what I was impressed with during that particular game, the referee, Matt Chechen. Now, he's been used to doing two-man referee jobs all through the year, hasn't he, over in the NRL. He's come over, he's refed a couple of games already in this Four Nations series. He's doing a good job in the middle, isn't he?
He is. Referees have been criticised this weekend, haven't they? But it's good to see that this particular referee in general had a really good game, and he came out with his reputation still intact.
But amazingly so, New Zealand made over 600 metres more than the Welsh did over the course of the game. That's a massive amount of ground, isn't it?
It just shows how much possession they had during that game, really, and it just shows that Wales were always on the defensive back foot during those 80 minutes.
Having said that, for Wales, I thought once more, Elliot Keir really did stand up and put his head above the parapet. He's a player that I'm sure Bradford fans are certainly looking forward to seeing over there at Oddsall next season.
He had the big, didn't he? That's what it's about. During any game, rugby, when you're being so dominated by your position, it's all about standing up. It's all about standing up to be counted. I thought that's exactly what Elliot Keir did.
And former Warrington youngster Andy Brajcik as well. He had a big, big impact for Wales for me. He was all over the place. Defensively, he was very, very sound. Attacking-wise, he kept doing the second leg drive going. Made a very valuable 70 or 80 metres as well for the cause.
He did, Andy Brajcik. He started his rugby career off in a Blaze of Glory, didn't he? That's meant to go on to bigger and better things. Maybe went sideways a little bit in recent seasons, but he's certainly got his head back on track to maybe fulfil that early talent that everyone was expecting from him.
Surprisingly so, he's not been picked up by anybody yet. And there's a good player there, isn't there? With potential to be picked up. You think certainly he can do a job still in Super League.
Whether he could do a job in Super League, well, that's up to him to prove everybody wrong, isn't it? But certainly within the Championship, I'm surprised he's not being picked.
Big game as well from Craig Dopjack, another Bradford youngster who's now pushing his way through. He's in his mid-20s now. He's starting to make a mark.
He has been around a while, and now he's starting to produce the kind of form that everyone was expecting to produce a couple of years ago. Pretty similar to Andy Brajcik in the sense that he entered the world of Super League in the Blaze of Glory. Kind of went backwards a little bit, but now he's starting to push his way forward to be a more competent forward.
From a New Zealand point of view, though, was there anybody in particular that impressed you over the course of the 80 minutes?
I think one player that stood out for me during that game for New Zealand was Jeremy Smith. He just couldn't knock his work rate.
His work rate was superb, but for me, he still gives away too many penalties. The player that stood out for me was Adam Blair, when he could say that he hasn't played since that almighty Ruckus back in the NRL. I think he was banned with about three games to go. For him to come back, go straight into an international, and come out with the sort of stats that he did, tremendous effort from him.
Well, I mentioned two of their players, but the class out within that New Zealand team, a lot of rest on how he plays during those 80 minutes is Benji Marshall.
Did you think that was more like the Benji Marshall that we know, and we know what he can come up with?
I would say so. He wasn't absolutely at his best, was he, really? There's still a few gears you can go through, but he's still a dangerous player to have within your team.
The player that I think could really make a mark for New Zealand rugby over the next few years is Jared Beale, though. Now, he's played a fairly limited amount of first team rugby over there with the Brisbane Broncos so far in Australia. But Jared Beale, he really is a multi-skilled player. Last week he was playing centres, this week
someone who's got the ability to play in a number of positions, and that's exactly what Neil does.
Just Nightingale opened the score after 4 minutes. Jason Locke followed him after 14 minutes. Then Sikamanu landed a quick double after 20 and 31 minutes respectively. Jared Beale scored the first of two tries just before the break. And at 26 points to nil at half time, it looked like New Zealand were going to go and really lay Wales to waste in the second half.
Yeah, damage was done at half time. It'd be interesting to see what Jason Harris would have had to have said to the boys from Wales to really lift themselves up and come out in the second half, knowing the game had gone from them. In a sense, they did kind of respond and improved as the game got on, and they pushed New Zealand back onto the ropes a little bit.
I was impressed with Wales' second half. Now, I know you thought they were fairly limited throughout the game, to be honest, didn't you, Adrian? But I thought that they got out there, they had a big, they made things difficult for New Zealand in the second half. And certainly, I guess when the coaching staff comes to look at the video, it's not one that they'll be saving, I don't think.
I suppose a highlight for the second half for Wales, that big crunching tackle from Kopsak, which produced a broken jaw for Sam McKendry.
Yes, I think that's ruled McKendry out for the rest of the Four Nations tournament. It's ruled him out to the next game, which comes up against England. It was certainly a big hit, that's for sure. You know, the highlight for me, though, it was seeing Ian Watson once again get out there. He's extended his record. He's now finally said that he's going to be hanging up his international boots. He's been a brilliant servant for Welsh Rugby League, hasn't he?
He has. He's been there since 1995, hasn't he? And once again, he came off the bench and showed plenty of effort and commitment for the cause.
Always shows plenty of endeavour, doesn't he? And one thing you guaranteed, whenever Ian Watson goes onto a rugby field anywhere, they'll give total commitment. And you can't ask for anything more. And that's certainly what the public of Wembley saw on Wales on Saturday.
And the public were hoping maybe Wales was going to try and draw and prevent New Zealand from scoring any further points, and it looked like they were going to do it, weren't they? But they just couldn't find a way through that New Zealand defence when they got so close to the try line. And then New Zealand broke Welsh hearts on the 62nd minute when Gerald Beale went over, and then another try from Nathan Fain, and it was done and dusted at 36-0.
It was done and dusted, and it was a sad end really to the game, because I thought Welsh efforts did deserve some points. To be fair, they cut New Zealand open on about three or four occasions, but just lacked that little bit of cutting edge. It was similar to how they played against England, really, where they only converted one of about 10 chances, didn't they, in that game?
That's what it's about at this level of rugby league, isn't it? It's all about taking your chances, and if you don't, well, you're going to get bitten.
Now, you said some interesting things on Twitter, certainly about this particular game. Do you still stand by them?
I do, yes. I just don't see the point of having Wales in this Four Nations in both games being totally outclassed.
But you also said that a good championship one side would have probably given New Zealand more of a game. You stand by that as well?
I totally do, yes. If you look at the Welsh team anyway, it's made up of predominantly championship one players, and a lot of them are not the best players within that league.
You're just being controversial. I tell you, why do we bother with any international rugby league? That's the question which I pose to you, Mr. Jackson.
Well, we need international rugby league because that's all. It's all about spreading the Bible and getting the message out there. And the only way the game can progress to the levels that we expect as pundits and fans is to have a strong international game as well as a good club game.
But you don't think we've got that. So you were just saying, why is Wales involved?
Well, we've got it in the terms of England, New Zealand and Australia. Unfortunately, we're struggling to find another nation to compete at the same level as we're England, Australia and New Zealand now, but I suppose that'll come with time.
We've been saying that for 70 years, haven't we, with the fact that the French have been playing rugby league since the 1930s. Welsh rugby league has been on and off more times than I don't know what in the last 100 years or so. It is fascinating. I think that you've been a little bit harsh there, to be honest, on some of those lads, because they did, for me, pull the tripe out and deserve an immense reward. And I tell you what, I would love to actually get the opportunity. I'm sitting here in a Welsh jersey. Now, I don't have any Welsh blood in me, but I wish I did.
You can say what you like about the fact they gave their all, not knocking their efforts. At the end of the day, during those 80 minutes against New Zealand, and against Wales, and as we'll find out next week with the take on Australia, the boys pulling on that jumper are just not good enough.
But how are they going to get better, though, if they don't get the opportunity to play that standard rugby? How are they ever going to improve?
Well, that's the question I'm asking about France now. They've won that autumn series. Do they get promoted into to the Four Nations, the Willows get past the side for another season or so.
They could do it, they're all pulling it all together, couldn't they? For me, this is where the England Knights really do come into a world of their own, because they can take on those nations regularly, can't they, and give them that competitive rugby that they need.
Well, yeah, if they can come up with an international tournament involving the England Knights to play like France and Wales on a regular basis, well, that will help then coaches in terms of improving the standard of international rugby league.
Do you also think as well it could be an opportunity for bringing in academy internationals? A few years ago we used to have a real development structure, didn't we? We had under 24 internationals. If you go back long enough, that became under 21 internationals. The academy game started up in 1992 again, which was a regurgitation, if you like, of the old Colts leagues from the mid-80s. There doesn't seem to be that type of game, if you like, now, to test out some of these kids who are just pushing the way through.
Because you certainly do it at international level within the amateur game, because an under-18 England team will come and a France under-18 team, so they have it in the international level in the amateur scene, but unfortunately for the kids that age that are playing professional rugby league, it seems to have gone to the wayside.
It's kind of bypassed them, hasn't it? And it's, I think it's really sad when you consider that in years gone by, a touring Australian team or a touring Kiwi team would play against England under 21s. You've only got to go back 10 years to a great game which happened in Brentford, I'm sure it did, between a young England side and the Australians, which was the toughest game they had on their entire tour.
The one game that stands out for me, that was the one when it was a team involving a young Dan McGuire, Robbie Burrow, Tommy Gallagher, to name just a few of them players, and they actually made a big thing of England beating their counterparts over in Australia. Unfortunately, as we go to open age international, you just can't replicate it.
No, but I think that is the way forward, and that is the type of system that we need to be doing, and we need to be doing more of. I hope that there are believers' plans for developing that side of things. Anyway, I'll get off the soapbox, I'll kick it back under the table, because we've still got one more game with the Four Nations to bring everyone up to speed with. This was the big one, England and Australia.
Big game, big stage back at Wembley for the first time in 40 years, and unfortunately, it didn't go in favour of the whole nation, England.
Yeah, it's been a long time between drinks for going back to Wembley as far as the international game is concerned, and England made the best of starts, Ryan Hall flying at the corner. A superb finish, one of the best finishes to an international try I've seen in quite a while from young Ryan Hall. And he really is making a name for himself now, isn't he, Ryan Hall?
He is, and he's doing it on the international stage as well. And we already know about his talents on the wing for Leeds, Rhinos and Super League. And I'm sure with that performance at Wembley against the best Australia have got within their camp for 2011, I'm sure a couple of those NRL clubs will be making the note of his name.
We'll be making the note of the name of Billy Slater as well, because he went and busted his shoulder. Now, I believe it's a broken collarbone that he's actually suffered, so he's going to go under the knife to get that put right. He'll sadly miss the rest of the Gillette Four Nations tournament. It gives someone else a chance though, doesn't it? Darius Boyd moved off the wing, moved into fullback, played like a veteran.
Played like a seasoned experience fullback, didn't he? And that shows you the strength and depth within the Australian team, and if you know someone of the ability, don't forget that the current International Player of the Year in Billy Slater, and then put someone like Darius Boyd in there, and he didn't look out of place.
No, I mean, he's classed as one of the top three fullbacks in Australia, though, isn't he? You know, so, as well as being one of the top wingers, to have one of the top fullbacks just in one man, he's just tremendous. It just shows you what we're up against, really, as a nation, doesn't it?
Versatility, can't beat it.
Another player that deserves a pat on the back for his versatility, Luke Lewis. Now, he actually started out as a winger, club centre many moons ago. Over recent seasons, he's done that step that so many players do. He's perhaps slowed down just a little bit, moved inside, gone into the pack. He found himself back out on the wing and did a brilliant job, came up with a smashing try for Australia.
He certainly did. He is a man with a lot of ability, isn't he? And to have him on the flank as well, once again, we mentioned it. Strength in depth, and Australia just seems to have an abundance of it, don't they?
There's a lot being made of the X factor at the moment. That's certainly a big thing that's always on our house. I don't know about yours, Adrian, but for me, anybody mentions X factor, I just think of one player, Jonathan Thurston. He's got the X factor as far as Australia are concerned.
He certainly is the best scrum half in the world at the minute, isn't he? And he at Wembley. Whatever he does, he just turns to gold for the green and gold.
It does, yeah. I mean, he converted that first try from Luke Lewis, which put Australia 6-4 up. Yeah, and Jonathan Thurston, he was key in the movement, which led to big substitute Tony Williams pulling his way through and getting over the top of Chris Eyington.
His big powerhouse is Tony Williams, isn't he? There, he proved on that collision to be far too powerful for young Eyington to hang on to his bootlaces.
English went over after 44 minutes, and for me, that was a try that we've been seeing. He went upstairs to the video referee. It's one of those tries we've been seeing all the way through the season. It's been being ruled out in Super League. There was a possible obstruction, and nothing was said. That came after Ryan Hall's second effort, not a galloping effort, that was as well. Jack Reid, nice early delivery, and, well, Ryan Hall's finishing prowess did the rest, didn't it?
I gave England a better hope than there, because it looked like when English went over for the try, the Aussies were going to run away with this one, but England came back all guns blazing, and certainly they needed that try to keep them within touching distance of Australia.
It was an interesting call from the referee when he disallowed Tom Briscoe, who seemed to get over. He disallowed it for a double movement, but TV replays showed that his ball carrier never touched the ground. How can that be ruled as a double movement? I'm lost.
I'm sure everyone's asking the same question, but fair play to Steve Aminara. He came out after the game and he didn't say that decision cost England the game. It just made life hard for them.
He just left himself a bit short of actually blaming Aminara, didn't he?
He did, but he obviously didn't want to say something that he might regret in the heat of the moment.
Keeping up the heat of the moment was big Paul Gallen as he got sent through by Cooper Cronk. And England, they responded positively. There was a kick which was put up to the corner. Reid came down with it, scampered his way over for the remaining 50 metres. And although Eyington pulled a further try back with just 5 minutes remaining, lovely offload from Sam Tompkins in the build-up to that one, by the way. Australia finished strongly. They had Darius Boyd going over after 73 minutes. And Chris Lawrence scoring his second international try just a couple of minutes from the end. Yes, we were beaten. Yes, it was by 16 points. Yes, we gave our all. We're still not quite there, though, are we?
Since we're on the RST, enjoyed that game as well, didn't we? Worryingly for Steve McNair is the fact that Australia finished the strongest of the two teams.
They did, and the worrying thing for me when you look at that is whenever the Australians tend to play one game against England, we all get excited, don't we, because England make a real game of it, and yet they come up against them a little bit later on in the tournament and usually get to our rugby lesson. Let's hope that's not forthcoming in the final.
Oh, so you're confident England are going to be a new team when they get to the final?
I was confident. You've already written them off anyway. Why should I not be confident anyway?
I'm sure the whole nation is highly confident that England will beat New Zealand. I'll be honest with you, I think based on that performance, if England can play like that against New Zealand, I think they've got a good chance.
I mean, to be fair as well, England also lost two members of the starting pack, didn't they? James Graham hardly played after half time. And then when Jamie Peacock went off, there was a real loss there. We're hearing all kinds of rumours about how bad his injury was. I guess this would mean an opening for someone like Gareth Carvell to step up, wouldn't it?
Well, Carvell was on the bench, wasn't he, during that game? He never got on, so he'd been kicking his heels in frustration. But it was a good opportunity for Gareth Carvell to leave the line against New Zealand next week in the absence of Jamie Peacock.
Now, you mentioned as well it was one of Adrian Morley's less noticeable international performances, shall we say.
He got off a lot of work in defence. I mean, he made 30 tackles, but in terms of an effect, an impact on attack, he seemed to be struggling to break the line, didn't he?
He did, and I'm just looking at the stats in Australia. He still made 200 metres more than England in the game, so he still went twice the length of the field, didn't he?
And that's the difference between winning and losing the game. It just shows once again, like New Zealand against Wales, Australia dominated things up front.
And we picked out in the previous game that we talked about, we picked out Benji Marshall, and perhaps the fact that he hasn't fired an all cylinders yet. You could say the same about Darren Lockie, couldn't you?
Well, it's been revealed now that Darren Lockie was carrying an injury during that game against England at Wembley. The Australians decided to keep hush about it, and maybe that'll explain why it's been now. expect like, him to have a quiet compared to his own high standards within the game, and it will play more thankfully for him. And Australia, there's other guys that can do the work for him, and then getting Jonathan first, and you've got the perfect backup.
Yeah, last week when we were doing our bit of a preview to this particular game, I said that England needed to get Cameron Smith totally tired out with the amount of tackling that he was going to do. Remember, he made 54 tackles last week against New Zealand. He followed it up this week with another 37 tackles against England. The man's a machine.
He is, isn't he? I'm sure he won't disagree with that statement. He is a tackling machine. And that just gives Australia that bit of steel in the middle of the field when they need it.
I'm also really happy that there was a couple of other big tacklers, because I think last week, when we ran through the Australian lineup, there was only two other players who made over 30 tackles in their particular team. And when you look at that over the course of the 80 minutes, Sam Vidic came up with 33 tackles, Anthony Watmore came up with 37 tackles, and Chris Lawrence out in the centres came up with 27 tackles. That just shows you there was a bit more sharing of the workload, really.
Maybe they were listening to this podcast and they thought we better put our socks up here and get it on the app in terms of defence. One worrying thing for Australia, they need to concern themselves about ahead of the Four Nations finals appearance for 2011, so that Tony Williams might not be there, because he's been placed on reports for an alleged high tackle on Ben Westwood. And interestingly, since that game finished, now this isn't confirmed, but Ben Westwood said he did a bit of a play act.
I read something like this. Yeah, he's actually gone in one of the newspapers and said that he played better a little bit after getting hit. That's not the type of stuff that I'd be wanting him to play with. He's been too honest there, he's Ben Westwood. We've always praised him for his honesty on the field of play, but he was really hard worker all the way through that game with Ben Westwood. But he just tended to lose it a little bit after getting that headshot, didn't he?
Now, when he's saying that, he tried to say rugby players will be like footballers, and they'll start play at them when they're getting hit to get a penalty or get a play sent off.
We don't need any more criticism of Super League. We've already got enough from the NRL people, haven't we, to be honest. But I see the point which you're getting at. Could we see the first European claimsman of the Super League generation coming through?
If it is, it's a worrying time for rugby league, and it's something that needs a nip in the bud, because if that is correct, that Ben Westwood did make a bit of a play for it, I think maybe he should knock him a couple of quid out of his wages.
Okay, so we've done the game, we've done the scorers, we've done Tony Williams on his head high tackle, which I think he should have been stimming for anyway, because it wasn't a tap to the head. We've even talked a little bit about play acting. Let's go to the chase. Anki, how do you think you went?
Everyone's favourite halfback at the moment, isn't he, Randy Chase? It's been a controversial decision to even select him, to be honest. And surprisingly, he's not lived up to the billing that Man of Steel joined the tournament, has he?
I think he's tried a few things, and I think that certainly over the course of the coming weeks, it's going to get harder for him, isn't it? Because he's going to be up against the country of his birth next week, you know, New Zealand. And I suppose, well, alongside you, you're playing alongside a natural loose forward. You've got to adapt your game, haven't you, somewhat, because you've not got a natural number six there alongside you. But I don't know. I've not been unimpressed by him. I wouldn't say he's actually set the world on fire, but he has been willing to try things. And certainly a few halfbacks down the years when they pulled on an English shirt just seemed to get a sudden attack of the jitters and don't do anything.
Sure, you can't look for that. He has been trying, maybe he's trying too hard, that's why he's probably making a few mistakes and falling off the tackles a little bit. But in terms of his selection, there must be scrum hearts or British born or English born looking at his selection thinking I'm better than him.
Also, you look at his stats from the game. He's England's most valuable meter maker during the last game against Australia, which perhaps speaks volumes in itself. Where were the rest of the back?
I mean, I can't see a scheme up now. They're bowing to the pressure and dropping Randy Chase. I think he's going to persevere with him. He's made the call to bring him in. So he's not going to back down now and say, sorry, Randy, we're going to drop you now and bring in Sir Richie Mahler. But I think if he's going to persevere with Randy Chase, I think they need to bring in a more naturally gifted stand-off. I don't think Sim Field is the man for the job at stand-off.
You know what I do? I think that Chris Hyington has been a big letdown so far. Now, I know he's a player who really tends to get the mentions, and he's a bit of a workhorse, but for me, he just doesn't put the mustard at. His attempted tackle on Tony Williams was awful for me. He just threw his body at him and didn't use any sort of technique. switch Kevin Sinfield to 13, Sam Tompkins in at 6, Randy Chase at 7, Gareth Widdop in at the back. Simple as coaching game, isn't it?
It is, and that sounds like it gives England a bit more balance, doesn't it? Because you've got two naturally gifted, two natural halfbacks who are dominating play. You've got Sinfield going back to his own natural position, and Tompkins. So you've got Widdop, who did come into the England team as a fullback last year anyway. So that will give England a bit more balance. With Tompkins as well at halfback, it involves him more in the game as well.
Well, every time that Tompkins actually got involved in the game, the Aussies were running scared. They didn't know what he was going to come up with. He was stepping off the left, stepping off the right, twisting, trying to get the offload away. He got two brilliant passes away during the course of the game. He led to two tries.
And that's increased his reputation for probably one of the best young players within the World Rugby League at this moment as we speak. And the World War II concerns are within the World Rugby League and Super League about how much longer we Warriors could keep over Sam Tompkins. So it's been confirmed now. He's actually going to stay with the Warriors for at least 3 years because he's agreed to sign a 12-month extension, making him the highest paid player within Super League.
Tell you what, I mean, that's three contracts in 3 years for Sam Tompkins. If I was his agent, I'd be giving myself a big pat on the back. But for me, he deserves it.
He does, because he's worth every penny. We're getting a good pay him as well. And it's all about keeping young players like that within the game in this country, not letting them go over to the dark side or even over to Australia there, I say it.
You were talking about the dark side going over to Australia there. Sorry, I'm an Australian listeners. Talking about the dark side, one young Wigan player has decided to make that move. I'm talking about Joel Tompkins. He's opted to go across the Saracens. Interestingly, that Joel Tompkins decided to rule himself out of selection for this Four Nations tournament. How do you think he'd settle into the game? A completely different game, in opinion.
That'd be a million-dollar question that everybody will be asking, and I'm sure Rugby League fans will be watching his progress very closely, wanting to see whether he is a success or not. Can it be a success? Was only found all success within the Rugby Union? I don't think he was. Was he? Joel Tompkins is originally a forward. He's been playing at centre, a substitute centre for Wigan. Did such a good job. He ended up staying there to the end of the season. Now, what kind of role Saracens are going to give him within Rugby Union? I haven't got a clue.
It's very interesting, as is the fact that Saracens have actually announced that they're doing this link up with Wigan. Now, where is that going to lead?
Could it be another Saracens raid on the youngsters of Wigan Warriors?
Certainly, Sale Sharks tried it a couple of years ago, didn't they? They had Ian Thorne ended up moving from Wigan across to the dark side of Rugby Union. Have they spotted some more youngsters coming through, do you reckon?
Maybe that's what they're thinking. Maybe these guys who are in the youth set for Wigan, we might be hungry for a chance to play in Rugby Union rather than Rugby League, which is worrying for our sport.
Anyway, I digressed, didn't I? But certainly looking at that, you kind of like thinking, I've not tuned into a Love Rugby Union podcast, so I'll best shut up now and let's get back to the game in hand, Rugby League. The game returned to Wembley. What was your thoughts of the day? Certainly, there was a decent crowd. I won't say a great crowd, but it was a decent crowd. 42,344 was the official attendance that was announced. Was that better or worse than what you expected?
If you go off what the RFL were pointing out, they were hoping to get at least 50,000, weren't they? But they never got that. So they got within touching distance. It's a healthy start. But Wembley hasn't been at Wembley on the international stage for such a long time. So to get 42,000 down there on a cold November Saturday afternoon, it's fair going. You can't say that, not the RFL for trying it. The trick is now though, is to try and build on that. And hopefully the interest will gather momentum.
Need to follow it up now, don't they? So they need, next time they have an international competition, no matter what the international competition, they need to take a game down there, don't they, to London?
I think they do, because by doing it at the national stadium, it raises the game on a national stage, doesn't it?
And it was great to see it given such a high precedence on the BBC over the weekend. Now, I know we have been big pushers of exactly what Sky have done for the game, and they have done an awful lot of good, haven't they, in getting the game some wider exposure. But for me, you can't be getting a good rugby league game shown on terrestrial television.
And the BBC do that well, don't they? And that's what it's about. By taking it to Wembley, you get the national exposure from the press and the media. Would you have got the same exposure if that game had been played in the Huddersfield without it?
I think with that as well, it was short on most of the BBC bulletins as well, wasn't it, over the course of the evening. How often does that happen? Not very often these days.
I'm not being disrespectful to Huddersfield, by the way. It's just the fact that our game would have been played at Huddersfield. It wouldn't have got the national exposure that we got. So to get that exposure on the BBC, that's all about raising the profile of our players. And also, did you like Four Nations tournaments as a game of rugby league?
Perhaps they can look at whatever they're doing in preparation for the World Cup, having the final of whatever competition that's going to be next year at Wembley. What do you reckon?
Yeah, so the first time they've had the World Cup final at Wembley, haven't they? Everyone powered down there to see them take on Australia a few years ago, more than a few years ago, and that's when Steve Renoff broke everybody's hearts. And there was a decent crowd on that occasion, but that was way back in the day, wasn't it? It's all about 2011, and I'm sure maybe in time the NFL might look at that and think, yeah, maybe it is worth a go having a World Cup final at Wembley.
Also, actually insinuating at World Cup finals, but I was thinking that they needed to follow it up very, very quickly with something else. But you've hit on something that I reckon that a World Cup final would get at least 60,000 people going watching it.
You'd hope so. You'd hope that'd be the case. If rugby league fans won't want to go down to Wembley to watch our national team play the World Cup final against, say, Australia or New Zealand, where we've got a serious problem, haven't we?
Tell you where I'm coming from, though. I think that 42,000 is a fairly healthy attendance. I think that that is a good starting point, like you mentioned. I'm full of agreement for you there. It's probably one of the only times over the course of the season we have agreed in 40 episodes. That leads us very nicely onto what's coming up this weekend. Now, it's the penultimate weekend of rugby league action this particular season. It's almost time for us to go. But before then, let's just have a look at these two games coming up. What do you reckon? It's England taking on New Zealand over in Hull. New Zealand, they're going to be given a really stern welcome, aren't they, by those Hull fans?
Yeah, they speak very proudly of it. Super late, they said the atmosphere at the KC Stadium is really scary at times because they can be very vocal, using some very choice words towards the opposition, don't they, to really pull them off the game. So it'll be an experience for the New Zealand players to go up there and see such a vocal crowd that's going to be against them. Whether it works in England's favour, well, that's down to the boys that are wearing the England kit.
Brendan Chase is certainly looking forward to it. He's already commented this week that he can't wait to get the whole fans on his side for once, because he's been going there for the past few years wearing a Castleford Tigers jumper, and they've been tearing strips off him.
Maybe that's why he's been saving his best performance. He's been saving it for the game against New Zealand.
Could be a whole of a performance, couldn't it, from him?
I mean, looking at the game as a whole, it's a winner-take-all situation, isn't it? I mean, the game the day after between Wales and Australia know that they're going to be in the final for Wales. Can they get that elusive victory before the Gillette Four Nations end of 2011? But all the excitement and all the focus is going to be on the game and in the hole between England and New Zealand, because there's so much resting on it.
We've already touched upon the potential problems that England could have a prop out of this game. New Zealand will also be down on props. We spoke earlier about McKendry breaking his jaw. That's a big loss for them as well, isn't it?
It's a big loss for both teams, isn't it? And I think this game is going to be a real test of how much strength and depth in your squad you've got.
And who does have that strength and depth? If I was a betting man, if you were going to actually get off the fence and make a call for this one, are you backing the Silver Firm or are you backing the St George flag?
To be honest with you, I'm going to put the maths on the flag of St George. I think England have shown enough during the game against Austria that they can take that game one step further. And with one or two decisions going in their favour, I think they might be too strong for New Zealand. But New Zealand are the game's healthy. I think either England are going to get anything out of the game. They've got to make sure Benji Marshall doesn't dominate the middle of the field and also try and cut down on the space that they might allow to Thomas Lee, like, as he can be dangerous.
Yeah, I think you've picked up the two key players there for New Zealand, that Thomas Lulai and Benji Marshall. Now, Benji Marshall has failed to fire so far in this tournament. Could this be the day? England need to move up, they need to get in his face, they need to put him under pressure. If you put any halfback under pressure, you take his forward momentum away, you stop his Australians, because there was a few players there who weren't really big names. I'm thinking lads like Dave Whittle were playing for Wales at the time, lads like Chris Morley as well. So we could be building up the Welsh here for the biggest game of all time.
They've got nothing to lose, have they? They know they can't make the finals, so they might as well just go out now and play with a lot of passion and hold their heads high and hope they come off the field with the reputation still intact. As for Australia, they won't know anything about the Welsh team building, so I don't know about yesterday night. They won't know anything about the opposition. And they'll be expected to win it quite easily. But when you get into that way of thinking, that can be dangerous, because if you take something for granted, it can come back and haunt you.
If you were Tim Sheens, you was looking down your Australia lineup, you're thinking, I've got a couple of players who I haven't used yet. Billy Cherry Evans, for example, they brought him over. He's been the best rookie all season for Manly Sea Eagles. Came within whiskers of actually nailing his fact in England mast at one point, but that's another story entirely. Would you actually pitch him into this battle? See what he's got.
I think with the injury to Dallin Lockyer being confirmed by the Australians, I think that will give Tim Sheens an opportunity to drop Dallin Lockyer and maybe not drop Dallin Lockyer and rest him with the nation's final in mind and bring in Danny Cherry Evans to see how he goes on the international stage.
He's an exciting kid. I don't know whether you've seen much of him, but I certainly saw him in the NRL Grand Final, and he certainly goes well for it that way. So it's going to be a big day in Wrexham. But I can't see past a comfortable Australian victory.
That's the truth of the game, isn't it? Really, Australia, they're powerful, they've got pace, they've got power, they've got experience, world-class players, aren't they? World-class players, they'll be just pleased that they're mixing it with the big boys, but unfortunately, that can only take you so far, can't it?
It can. So, that's taking place on Sunday. It's England against New Zealand at Hull on Saturday night. We'll be back next week for episode 41 of Talking Points, where we'll look back over those two games and we'll look forward to the Gillette Four Nations final.